Okay, well, welcome everyone to a tag team event at the Loud Impact Centre today. For any of you interested in international criminal law, and I take it by your presence that means all of you, it's a great treat for us today to have with us, both from Temple Garden Chambers, Kirin Khan QC and Roddy Dixon. I noticed actually on your emails, one of you is just Khan at TG Chambers, and one of you is R. Dixon. Is that sort of like gentlemen and players in the old cricketing days?
No, I think I was difficult with the clerks, and I said, make it shorter.
Right. Okay. It's also very old school, isn't it? Anyway, between them, they are pretty much a catalogue of international criminal legal proceedings, really. If you go onto the Chambers website, you find lists as long as both of your arms. Kirin, for example, the Celebici case, Delalich, Akeyesu, Limai, Taylor, the Duch case in the... is that Duch, that guy?
Duch, yes.
Yeah, in the Cambodian Chambers. And so on and so forth, even the case of Florence Hartmann, who was held in contempt of the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, equally contributor, editor, author, etc. And so too with Rodney, Kenya's situation, Haradinaj, Libya, etc., etc., both of them working at the coalface of international criminal law. And when I was at a session recently in the Foreign Office where these guys were speaking, I was fascinated to see how much of it is the nitty-gritty that only someone involved in it would know. And so that's the perspective that we hope to hear from both of them today. They will be speaking on the ICC's role in promoting international justice, a comparison of the Sudan, Kenya and Libya situations. Now, for us, the outsider, we may have our views, but I look forward to hearing from both of you, Kirin and Rodney. So take it away, please.
Well, thank you so much for that introduction, and for all of you to give up your lunch times to be here. I understand some of you are studying very hard for exams, so again, our thanks for sparing the time. I think the idea today in the next 30 minutes or so is for Rod and I to carve it up between the two of us, but to give, hopefully, at least half an hour to questions. I think the interactive element is always the most interesting for everybody. As the topic on the board says, we can't hope to deal with the whole of the ICC. And I think a few maybe disjointed comments in relation to three particular situations, namely Sudan, Libya, and Kenya, may be in order. And there may be some clear blue water, maybe as much as the Mediterranean, between Rod and myself when it comes to certain issues. But when we start with Sudan, and both Sudan and Libya were referred to the court under Chapter 7 of the UN Charter. Of course, a determination was made by the Council that those situations constituted a threat to international peace and security, and therefore the ICC was viewed as part of the tapestry, part of the architecture on the international plane to help resolve, calm down those situations. That was the hope. My own view is that one can't really complain, no Sudanese can't complain that the case was referred, because there had been for many, many months, if not years, a very consistent stream of information from states, NGOs, and from fleeing civilians, that a campaign of terror had been unleashed against them by the Khartoum-led government. The victims themselves, their accounts, were quite horrific. There is a question, however, about due process, and this is something maybe Rod will discuss in due course. Sudan was not entitled, was not given an opportunity to make representations before the Security Council at a time when the Council itself referred that situation to the court. And it may well be that in due course, a better process for the Security Council itself to adopt would be to form itself almost as a quasi-judicial body when making that referral, and to allow, consistent with the Ordi Alterum Partem principle, allow the states concerned to appear before it and present arguments as to the merits or otherwise of referral at that time. If that doesn't take place, then there's going to be a lottery. Either a state in the council at the time will be in an advantaged position because of the rotation policy. If they're not a P5, they'll be entitled to make submissions and put its views across. But if a country is not on the council, it will not be afforded that basic opportunity to address those decision makers as to the merits of referral. So I think that's a real issue for the council, and ultimately it goes to the credibility both of the UN system and the Security Council in particular, and then by implication the ICC itself. There is then another problem in Sudan from my point of view. I represent the care interest. I represent there some of the rebels that are fighting against the Sudanese government. One of them was voluntarily surrendered and no charges were confirmed. Two others are awaiting trial. Rod is representing the victims of the alleged victims of that situation, and he's being assisted by the Sudanese Trade Union Federation, who are, we say, funded and supported by the Khartoum government. So there are issues there also about victims' lawyers participating in criminal proceedings almost as a stalking horse, almost as some kind of proxy for individuals who themselves have not submitted to jurisdiction. So Rod may have his own views about that. But when it comes to Darfur, again, we see the usual topsy-turvy, incoherent UN policy, because when it comes to Libya, the Chapter 7 referral did not take place in a vacuum. The international condemnation of what was unfolding in Libya was met with military intervention, humanitarian intervention, it was called, to help stop those egregious violations of international humanitarian law or massive and systematic violations of human rights law. We saw the same principle that was applied in Kosovo. A KFOR was established after NATO, and there's United Nations mission in Kosovo. When it comes to Darfur, there's no United Nations intervention at all, in military sense. The government of Sudan is free to commit its crimes against its civilians. And now that Angelina Jolie and George Clooney have gone on to other movies, it seems that the spotlight of the international community has left the people of Darfur and has moved to these new sexy, high-profile situations like Mali and Libya. Is that right? Well, is it right politically is one thing, but what are the legal ramifications? We put forward in the Darfur case an application to temporarily stay proceedings. Because unlike any other case anywhere else, the defence have not been permitted into the territory of Sudan to investigate. Not only that, it is a criminal offence for anybody in Sudan to cooperate with the court. And we know both from our asylum applications in England, the Country and Information Policy Unit of the Immigration Nationality Department, from the US State Department report, and from reams of human rights reports, that the Sudanese government is alleged to have engaged regularly in massive violations of people's rights in custody, torture, and conditions of detention amount to inhuman and degrading treatment. So we said until the Security Council, to put it bluntly, puts its money where its mouth is and intervenes, you can't expect the ICC to act as a fig leaf and have the pretense of a fair trial in circumstances where the prosecution can't investigate. And definitely, more directly relevant to us, we can't investigate ourselves the crimes for which the individuals are being charged. Now, Darfur is a unique situation for a whole variety of reasons, but one of them is that the suspects, and I think really this has not been properly appreciated, the suspects have voluntarily attended and surrendered to the jurisdiction of the court from a territory where the writ of the court simply does not run. I mean, this has never happened. You look at Nuremberg, look at Yugoslavia, look at Rwanda, look at it's never happened ever, ever before. And despite this, really, I think, very singular landmark event of submitting to justice, it seems that the court, unfortunately, is willing to hobble on, irrespective of these rights of the accused. And my own view was that a point must come where the international community intervenes and says, we want a trial, but not at all cost. And in the same way we have a United Nations mission in Kosovo, there needs to be a United Nations mission in Darfur. And in the same way we had a KFOR, there needs to be a military component. And until such time as these basic requirements are implemented, perhaps a fair trial cannot take place. And in that regard, it's not just the rantings of a partisan defence council. We were joined by both Justice Goldstone and other very eminent professors, as Mike Newton and others, who were all of the view in our stay application that in these circumstances it seemed that a fair trial would not be possible. But that has been given short shrift. When it comes to Libya, I think my the same comments can apply about due process and the referral. But what really I think will be under the microscope in Libya is the quality of investigations, firstly, that the prosecutor conducted. It's a big issue about the role of the prosecutor during the PrepComs. But I think anybody who saw Ocampo stand on TV, apparently investigations in tandem with CNN, Al Jazeera, and BBC World, and magicked, this massive dossier of, hearsay evidence, this report about Viagra, a whole crate of, or a whole container full of Viagra to help the Libyans' military commit rapes. It's that kind of imprecise lack of, that kind of investigation that lacks rigour is precisely the kind of overly expedient investigation that over time will do the ICC, in my view, irreparable harm. There is an issue now regarding cooperation with Libya. And Ron is representing Senussi there. I have a client who's the Prime Minister who's in custody. My own view is that, consistent with the Rome Statute and the idea of complementarity, the presumption must be that states, even under referral cases, try to apply justice themselves. You can speak about the legacy of these courts until the cows come home. But the best way of leaving a sustainable, real, tangible legacy is not for all the internationals to fly off to the next disaster zone or to the next international court, but it's to foster a homegrown sense of justice. So I'm not at all against Libya's view that these individuals should be tried in Libya. The question is, the trial must be fair and consistent with international standards. And at the moment, there's a bit of a face-off between the ICC and the Libyan governments. And I think to break that impasse, maybe the ICC should not, and certain individuals should not fight too hard about the principle of Libya having trials. It must be on the genuineness of Libya to ensure that those trials are fair. And only if the latter cannot take place, should the ICC then act as a residual mechanism to take over those cases. The last case, but I don't want to go on too much, of course, is Kenya. Unlike the other two, this is the first case before the ICC that was initiated pursuant to the prosecutor's Article 15 proprio motu powers. And it's a very interesting case for a whole variety of reasons, because it may show the beginning, or if not the beginning, a pattern that the ICC may run the danger of becoming a post-election violence court, because we have the Kenya situation, we have the Cote d'Ivoire situation with Gbagbo, and in which the winning side somehow takes off political opponents and passes them off to the ICC. Now, we have elections coming up in Kenya in March and April, In these situations, there needs to be real vigilance, in my view, that the international community, and more importantly, more specifically, the ICC, does not meddle in domestic affairs without a very solid foundation. And I think what this these trials of the Kenya situation will reveal, this is my prediction, is that the prosecutor latched on to information streams that at their head were somewhat polluted by political objectives, and swallowed uncritically various assertions which I think will not be able to stand up to scrutiny. So it's not a recipe for inaction. All I'm saying is that I think when it's a recognition that when the ICC is involved in states and the fabric of democracy of those states may be affected, one can't go in as the Americans feared. You know, some kind of cowboy prosecutor. One does need sober prosecutors built upon proper investigations and a proper basis, and be very alive to the very complex situations of these countries. And anybody who thinks that because it's Africa and, you know, it's a one-size-fits-all formula that somehow Cote d'Ivoire is the same as Kenya, or Kenya is the same as Liberia or Sierra Leone, it's a different, absolutely different country, obviously, but with a different amount of complexity. And I think thus far, maybe the ICC has been a little bit too naive in how it has entered those particular countries. So that's just a very quick tour of three different situations and some haphazard issues. And then we can pass that to Rod.
Yes.
Maybe we can add some organisation to it.
Thanks. I wanted to talk about these three situations because you probably are aware that there's been a lot of criticism of the ICC's approach to only selecting African countries and not having any investigations outside of Africa, which remains the case even after the new prosecutor from Africa has been put in place. That's a separate discussion which we can have, but I think we also need to look at, well, what cases have they got and how have they dealt with those cases to see whether it has been a step forward for international justice or whether we're still at a stage where we're going to have to assess the progress that has really been made. As Karim said, these situations are automatically different from the outset because Sudan and Libya were referrals through the Security Council, the only two that have come to the ICC under Chapter 7 so far. Whereas Kenya, the Security Council didn't get involved, it was at the initiative of the prosecutor. Even though there was a possibility that Kenya might have referred itself, as other African countries have done. But in this situation, in the end, the prosecutor had to take action. And I wanted to focus on that very first stage. I think that's fundamental to assessing the justice implications, which is what is the jurisdiction of the court, what is the admissibility of these cases before the court, and the powers of the court. But I think when you look at that, without going any further, you do see a number of inconsistencies that have emerged and which are going to have to be dealt with and engaged with and explained by the court over time. There are some consistencies as well, and I'll highlight them at the end. But I wanted to focus first on the jurisdiction admissibility inconsistencies. You will probably know that Kenya made a challenge to keep the cases in Kenya. Libya has made a challenge to keep Saif Gaddafi's case. It's an open question whether they've actually done it in relation to al-Sanusi yet. And arguably they have not done it yet and may still have to do so if they do wish to keep the case. Sudan, on the other hand, has simply refused to engage with the court altogether. They haven't looked at trying to make any challenges to say, look, we will deal with this here. Although they have taken certain initiatives to have investigations, to have prosecutors, arguably those haven't progressed that far yet. But they have taken some of their own internal initiatives, but they haven't sought to then put that before the court. They've simply taken the point of view that this was an unlawful action to refer them to a court that they haven't signed up to, which is in and of itself an issue that's hanging there in the air. The ICC is not going to look at that issue. I don't think. I think potentially it could, under its general inherent powers to review how cases came before it. But I don't think there's going to be an appetite for the ICC to look at it. It's a potentially a question that could be resolved by the ICJ, though. What are the powers of the Security Council in relation to referring countries to a criminal jurisdiction and putting their heads of state essentially on trial when they have not consented to that jurisdiction? And within that, there lies the issue of head of state immunity as well for those countries who haven't signed up to the statute. Potentially, it could apply to even those who have, are sitting heads of state fair game, given the immunities that usually apply because of the need for fostering and protecting international relations and interests. But certainly for a state that hasn't signed up, is the Security Council able to say, well, tough luck, your immunity is now stripped for the purpose of this court, and you have to hand yourself over to that court. So those are issues that are alive, which have certainly been put on the agenda by Sudan, and are going to remain there until a court is seized of them and is prepared to address them. But then also there's the question that arises, because these cases came from the Security Council, what happens if states don't obey the referral? Of course, even states who haven't had their situations referred by the council could face potential referral to the Assembly of State Parties or possibly to the Security Council. But with a Security Council referral, it's very direct. If you don't comply, then the matter has to come back to the Security Council to be considered. Now, I think here we see a striking inconsistency automatically between the Sudan and the Libya situations. In Sudan, the court has been very ready to send Sudan and other countries, including Malawi and Chad, back to the Security Council, saying, you haven't complied with our resolution. We gave this matter to the court. The court has ordered that various people who are charged in Sudan should be handed over. That hasn't happened. The Security Council needs to address it. And when President Bashir traveled to Chad and Malawi, and they said, yes, you can come, the court, in a flash, really, referred both those countries and those violations to the Security Council for consideration. When it comes to Libya, even though this matter has now been dragging on for nearly a year and a half, with arguably no decisive action yet on the part of the Libyan authorities, No referrals to the Security Council as yet. And arguably there could certainly have been one already when Mr. Al-Sanusi was, as you know, arrested in Mauritania. Mauritania is a member of the UN. As a member of the UN, it is bound by Security Council Resolution 1970 to cooperate with the court. When he was arrested there, the court asked for him to be handed directly to the ICC, was simply ignored. And in the end, what happened, as has been alleged in many reports, is that he was handed over to Libya for a large sum of money, which really amounts to an unlawful rendition. So arguably both Mauritania and Libya, as accomplice states, were involved in a clear violation of a Security Council resolution, clear violation of the international obligations. ICC has done nothing, no referral to the Security Council. Now, if Chad and Malawi and Sudan had done things like that, you can answer for yourself what you think the response would have been. So why this inconsistency? Why the difference? I mean, it appears as though Libya has been given a much wider berth. For what reasons, and are there really legal justifications for that? Politically, there might be justifications, but can the court really allow for those political issues to allow for different legal standards to be applied? I mean, you're either in violation of an international obligation or you're not. And the resolutions are exactly the same in terms of the referral processes. Then just on The admissibility challenges themselves, they're just four further inconsistencies that I wanted to highlight. And this is for the purpose of trying to assess with you whether or not at this stage we do have a coherent practice that is developing before the ICC. I think not. I think there are some places where it's beginning to come together, but these are matters that do have to be seriously addressed if the court is going to be seen as a legitimate court dealing with questions of how do you interface between national and international justice. It's a very challenging and new area, but one in which, unless there's principled consistency, I think that the project's going to be seriously damaged going forward. Admissibility. Differences here in particular between Kenya and Libya, because there's been no admissibility challenge in relation to Sudan. Firstly, from the point of view of the prosecution, in relation to Kenya, the prosecutor took a very clear stance saying that the Kenyan cases were his, that they were his to deal with, and that no one was going to take those away from him. Of course, an admissibility application could be made as it was, but he fought it tooth and nail. With regard to Libya, a much more standoff stance of, well, let's let the process take its course. Some would say a stance which has really said, yes, Libya can have these cases. I don't necessarily want them. And therefore, in the applications that have been filed, the position of the prosecutor has been somewhat different, not only in terms of stance, but then, which is my second inconsistency, in terms of the legal position taken as well. Essentially, for Libya, the prosecution has said the whole purpose of admissibility is to assess whether a country is shielding people. That's what it's there for. If it's shielding, sorry, they are cases. If not, well, fine, you can go ahead. And even if there are human rights violations occurring, that's not part of the admissibility equation. The court can't get involved in whether or not you are torturing those people there and say, no, they would have come over. Or if they're facing the death penalty, tough luck. That's in a nutshell what the prosecutor is saying, is that providing you're not shielding, you can do whatever you want in your national jurisdiction. There's no threshold. There hasn't even been a concession that, well, if there are egregious human rights violations taking place, the ICC can't let that happen. They've got to bring the case to the ICC. That hasn't been said. Whereas in the Kenya application, it was made quite clear both that the state needs to be investigating, but also that they need to be able to properly conduct the proceedings. And their allegations were made, which were largely, in my view, unfounded, about the government being involved in witness intimidation and being involved, therefore, in preventing a fair trial from taking place. So the prosecution went much further and did actually look at the human rights issues in relation to Kenya, which hasn't happened in Libya, despite, I think, as you all know, the widespread reports of the violations that are occurring. I mean, in relation to the people Karim mentioned, Saif Gaddafi and El Sanusi, I mean, they've essentially been held in incommunicado detention for months and months and months now, with very few visits, even from the ICRC and international organizations. And the argument that's put forward by Libya is that, well, we're in a transition phase and, you know, it's quite difficult to manage things, and it's the usual, well, maybe you can derogate, but there is no provision to derogate from these rights, and there should be no reason why these rights can't be protected. But there's a deafening silence at the moment from the international community generally. There might be, as many say, some of the most reviled people in the world, but they have exactly the same rights under the African Charter, the Universal Declaration, as anyone. And it is, I think, a very important question to see whether the international community will be prepared to apply the same standards to people like that, even though many say that the evidence against them is very strong. But that's irrelevant. It doesn't affect their rights as detainees. And then, thirdly, the third inconsistency is also the question of how long a state should be given to get its act together to try people. In Kenya, the court was very firm. They said, you've got to make your application. Everything's got to be in your application from day one. You can't add anything afterwards, and you must show us at the time you made your application you can do this trial. Otherwise, tough luck, we're moving on. And the timelines that were set were extremely tight. There was a dissenting opinion from one of the judges on the appeals chamber saying really Kenya should have been given more time because it's such an important matter. It's the first admissibility challenge. So that's worth looking at. With regard to Libya, extension after extension after extension has been given to the Libyans. And also they've been allowed to file new information. Whenever new information comes to light, there've been a series of applications where new material has been put before the court. And they were given a full oral hearing on the matter. And now the chamber has come back and asked for further inquiries, more questions, more information. So it's been seen as much more of a rolling process, giving them as much opportunity as possible to fulfill the standard, which arguably was the exact opposite approach that was taken with Kenya, cutting it off as quickly as possible. And then lastly...
No,
I'll
just clearing my throat.
I thought I was going over time.
Yeah, no,
that's okay. But lastly, just on the admissibility issue, access to evidence. In Kenya, the prosecutor and the court was quite clear. The government can't get access to the evidence that the prosecutor's got. The government argued, well, you know, how do you expect us to investigate the case if we can't get your evidence? Because you've probably got all the evidence from witnesses who are now outside of our country. So share it with us on proper confidential terms, and then we can prosecute these people in our own country. Court said no, can't do that. Libya, constant cooperation, sharing of evidence between the prosecutor and the Libyan authorities so that they can build up the cases. And no issue about, well, can we trust them or not, whereas there was, I think, underlying it all, essential allegation of, well, we can't trust the Kenyan government, that's why we're not going to give it to them. But can you trust the Libyan authorities, given their track record up until now. In terms of consistencies, one that I do wish to highlight, because it's not all conflictual, is that I think the court has made it clear in both Libya and Kenya that the state has to show that it has concrete investigations underway and evidence to back that up. And if you look at the latest ruling from the chamber in the Libya case, the kind of questions that they've asked Libya are all about, can you give us concrete information? And also, I think they've made it quite clear, and give us information about the human rights situation. So they don't appear on the face of it to be saying it's only about whether you're doing an investigation. They also seem to be looking at the fair trial and due process issues. But that's a matter that's still to be decided. I also think on violations of Security Council resolutions, even though there hasn't been a referral of Libya yet, that the chambers have made it quite clear what the binding nature of those resolutions are. They've been quite consistent about that. And also under the UN Charter made it quite clear you can't opt out of those obligations through the African Union or through saying you've got some other agreement. So there is consistency there. It's now a question of implementation. But I do think one of the biggest challenges for the court now is going to be how to deal with the Libya situation, especially in the wake of what happened with the trials in Iraq and Saddam Hussein, and remember the awful pictures of the executions that occurred there. We're heading in the same direction with regard to these other people that are on trial or about to go on trial there. And unlike with Iraq, the ICC wasn't in place and overseeing that. But these cases are before the ICC, referred to the ICC by the international community, by the Security Council. And we therefore have an obligation to ensure that human rights standards and international standards are applied. It will be a very challenging issue for the court to resolve. But it has to do so. It has to ultimately decide. It's in its hands whether or not Libya can do these cases, or should it come to the ICC and if they refuse to hand them over, well then it's a matter for the Security Council to deal with through appropriate remedial action. But then the court has at least, in my view, done what is right by ensuring that the principles that are enshrined in the Charter and in the statute from which the referral came are adhered to. Okay.
Thank you very much for coming to us. We do hope you come back because this is exactly the sort of to and fro and fireside chat that we love. And it was great. Thank you.